When he heard his name called, he hunched his shoulders rather than turn. But a hand dropped lightly on his arm.
Reed, it's Officer McVee.
He gave her a blank look. Her hair fell down her back in a bouncy, honey-blonde ponytail. She wore a plain white t-shirt and khakis. She looked younger.
Sorry, I didn't recognize you. No uniform. Were you at the funeral?
No, I waited out here. I called your house. Your mom told me where you were.
I gave my statement and all, a couple times.
I'm off duty. I'm just, well, trying to do my own personal follow-up with anybody I connected with that night. For myself. Are you going to the cemetery?
No, I don't feel right about it. Her family and all that. I didn't know Angie all that well. I was trying to get her to go out with me. We were maybe going to that same movie, the last show, and... Jesus.
He fumbled on sunglasses with shaking hands.
You want to go over to the park? Sit and look at the water for a while? It always helps me level out.
I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, I guess.
How about you ride with me and I'll bring you back for your car after?
Okay, sure.
When he thought of it later, he wondered why he'd gone with her. He didn't know her. She'd been a blurred face in a uniform inside the madness and shock. But she'd been there. She'd been in it, like he had. When he got in her car, he had a moment to think it was older and crappier than his, if a lot cleaner. Then he remembered.
You shot Hobart?
Yes.
Man, they didn't fire you or anything for it, did they?
No, I'm cleared. Back on the job tomorrow. How are your parents dealing?
They're pretty messed up, but they're handling it.
And the people at the restaurant?
I think it's harder. We were there, and we saw. You can't stop seeing it. But we're doing okay. Like Rosie, head cook, she's doing a lot of stuff. The funerals, hospital visits, taking food to people. It helps, I think. I don't know.
What's helping you, Reed?
I don't know.
He felt the air on his face through the open window, breeze off the water. That was real. Cars zipped by, a woman pushed a kid in a stroller down the sidewalk. All real. Life just kept going. And he was in it. Lucky to be in it.
I talked to Chaz a lot. My friend at GameStop.
I remember. He saved lives. So did you.
The kid, Brady? His dad called me. He wants to bring Brady to see me maybe next week. He said his wife's getting better.
Essie said nothing for a moment, but like Cece, she believed in truth and trust.
She's going to make it, but she's paralyzed. She won't walk again. He probably didn't want to lay that on you, but you'd find out.
God damn it. God damn it.
He put his head back on the seat until he could breathe clear again.
I try to listen to music or shoot hoops in the backyard, but I can't stop reading about it or listening to the news. I can't stop.
You were part of it.
My parents want me to see somebody. You know, a shrink or something.
It's a good idea. I have to see one. Department rules, and for a reason.
He opened his eyes again, frowned at her.
You have to talk to a shrink?
Already have. I'm cleared. It was a good shoot, for desk duty. And I'm talking to the department shrink. I'll be back on full active in a while. I don't mind working through it. I killed somebody.
She parked, turned off the engine.
I did it to save lives, including my own and my partner's. But I killed a 17-year-old boy. If I could just shrug that off without a single regret, I shouldn't be a cop.
She got out of the car, waited for him. They walked for a while, past a playground, along a promenade, then sat on a bench where gulls swooped and cried, and the bay rolled blue as the sky. Boats glided on the bay, and Reed heard kids laughing. A woman with a killer body inside spandex shorts and a tank jogged by.
A couple who looked 1,000 years old to his eyes strolled, holding hands.
Is it true what the papers and TV are saying, that Hobart was the main guy?
I'm going to say it's likely he was the strongest willed, pushed for the plan. But the three of them? It seems to me like they were pieces of a sick, sad puzzle that fit together and at the worst time. A few months sooner, a few months later, Paulson probably wouldn't have fit.
Reed knew what the papers and TV said about Paulson, what neighbors and teachers said. How shocked they were, how he'd never been violent, always bright and helpful. Fucking Boy Scout. They were putting Angie in the ground now. They'd put a kid on his first summer job in the ground yesterday. How many others?
I don't think you can kill like that. Just kill people the way they did if it's not in you. I mean, maybe, probably, everybody's capable of killing, but like you did, to save lives, to protect people. In self-defense, or like a soldier, that's different. But what they did, for that, something else has to be inside.
You're not wrong. I think with Paulson's background, his family, they'd have gotten him help. But he linked with the others at a dark time, and those pieces came together. He listened to the soft lap of the water, the call of birds, somebody's radio. Realized the world seemed more real as he sat there talking to her. He felt himself slide more inside it as he sat with her.
What was it like when you shot him?
I'd never fired my weapon off the range before last Friday night. I was scared shitless, she told him. But that mostly came before and after. In the moment, I guess it came down to training and instinct. He shot my partner. I could see people dead and dying. He shot at me, and I just did what I'd trained to do, take out the threat. Then I had to do what came next. My partner, down but not seriously injured. There was the kid in the bathroom, the first 911 caller.
That's, Simone Knox.
Right. You know her?
No, I just can't stop reading and watching. I remember her name.
She's in your club. She saved lives. She kept her head, hid, contacted the police. Barry and I, my partner, were right outside in the parking lot.
I read that, too. You were right there.
It's playing out that Simone's call came in about a minute, maybe two, after Hobart pushed in the exit door he'd left unlocked. She lost a friend that night, and another's still in the hospital recovering. She's coping, but it's rough.
You talked to her, too.
To her, to her friend me, to Brady and his dad.
With a sigh, Essie lifted her face to the sun.
It helps me, and I'd like to think maybe it helps them.
Why'd you become a cop?
Seemed like a good idea at the time.
She smiled, then sighed again as she looked out over the water.
I like order. I believe in law, but it's the combination that works for me. It's a good fit for me. Rules and procedure and trying to help people. I never saw myself in a situation like Friday, but now I know I can get through it. I can do the job.
How do you get to be a cop?
She turned her head, gave him a raised eyebrow.
Interested? Maybe.
No.
Yeah,
he realized.
I am. I never thought much about what I was going to do. Just get a job eventually. I like college. My grades are okay, but I just like being there, so I haven't been thinking too hard about what happens when I'm out. I told Brady we were waiting for the good guys, because we were. So, yeah, I'd like to know how to become a cop.
By the time she took him to his car, Reed had, for the first time, a life plan. It had forged itself out of death, but it was his life he could see rising from it. Selena McMullen had ambitions and a smoking habit.
Her ambition to rise to fame as an internet blogger put her outside the church during the funeral. As a reporter for Hot Scoops, with its somewhat questionable reputation, she didn't get much respect from the print and on-air reporters gathered outside. It didn't bother her. One day she'd be bigger than any of them. She'd developed both the attitude and the ambition during high school and college. There'd been no question in her mind that she was smarter than any of her peers, so she didn't have a problem letting them know it. If that meant she had no real friends, so what? She had clients. She credited Jimmy Rogers in eighth grade for helping her forge a clear path. By pretending to like her, telling her she was pretty, also she'd gullibly do his homework while he laughed behind her back, he'd provided her with the impetus to start her own business. Sure, she'd do homework assignments. For a fee. By the time she'd graduated high school, she'd had a considerable nest egg and had grown it throughout college. Fresh out of college, her journalism degree hot in her hand, she'd snagged a job on the Portland Press. It hadn't lasted long. She had considered her editor and her co-workers idiots and didn't trouble with tact. Still, she'd seen the internet as the future, and at 24 hitched her wagon to Hot Scoops. She worked primarily out of her own apartment, and since she saw her current position as no more than a stepping stone toward her own site, her own successful blog, she tolerated editorial interference and crap assignments. Then the Down East Mall massacre fell into her lap. She'd actually walked into the mall on a quest for new running shoes seconds before the first shots were fired. She'd seen one of the shooters, identified as Devin Lawrence Paulson, cutting his bloody swath, and had hunkered behind a mall map as she'd pulled out her camera, her recorder. She had scooped every paper, network, site, and reporter. As follow-ups, she'd dogged victims, family members, hospital staff. She'd bribed an orderly and gained access long enough to get a few pictures of patients, even slipped into one of the rooms after one had been transferred down from ICU. The recorder in her pocket had caught some of the conversation between Mee Hee Jung and, bonus, Simone Knox, for her to flesh out another story. By her calculation, she only needed a few more to take that leap off her current stepping stone. She'd already had offers. And now her smoking habit tossed another into her lap. She'd stepped away from the other reporters to have a smoke, moving a half block down to lean on a tree, smoke, and think. She could head to the cemetery when the church portion ended, but how many clicks would yet more pictures of people in black generate? Maybe someone would faint, like the dead kid's mother had the day before. But, well, been there, done that. Time for more dish on the shooters, she decided, and had nearly started for her car when she spotted the cop. Officer McVee, she thought, edging around the tree. She'd tried to pigeonhole McVee a couple of times. The young female officer who'd shot and killed John Jefferson Hobart equaled pure clickbait. McVee wasn't the cooperative sort, but right now, said cop was hanging back, avoiding the gaggle of reporters and cameras. Waiting. Interesting, Selena thought, settling down to wait herself. The casket came out, so she took a couple shots with her long lens, just in case nothing better came along. She watched McVee moving up and spotted one more prize. Reed Quartermain, teenage protector of the firefighter's kid, the kid whose mother took one in the spine. Selena took a couple shots of them talking, then walking together, then getting in the cop's car. And while everyone else headed to the cemetery, she ran to her own car. She nearly lost them twice, but considered that more good luck. If she looked like a tail, the cop might spot her. Running potential copy in her head, she parked a good distance away, watched from the car until her quarry settled on a bench. Pleased with the investment she'd made in the lens, she wandered as close as she dared. She was just one more person casually taking photos of the bay, of the boats. Maybe she couldn't get close enough to hear the conversation. The cop wouldn't talk to her. but she had her lead as she framed her shots. On another painful day in Rockpoint, death unites heroes of the Down East Mall massacre. Oh yeah, that leap was coming soon. Chapter 5. 3 years later. Simone rolled to sit up and nudged the man who shared her bed.
You gotta go,
he grunted. She knew his name, even knew why she'd decided to have sex with him. He looked clean, in good shape, and had wanted just what she had. Plus he had an interesting face, sort of chipped and chiseled and sharp. In her head, she'd seen him as a modern-day Billy the Kid, the hard-boned Western outlaw. It had taken her a while to embrace the idea that one-night stands had particular and peculiar advantages over the drama and hassle of relationships, or the pretext of them. It wasn't taking quite as long for her to realize they also carried a whole lot of boredom in their wake. The guy, Ansel, dressed in the dim glow of light through the window. She hadn't pulled the shades. Why bother? She liked looking out at New York, and didn't mind if some of New York liked looking back at her. He said,
I had a good time.
She said, me too. And meant it enough that it didn't qualify as a lie.
I'll call you.
Great. Maybe he would, maybe he wouldn't. It didn't matter much either way. Since she didn't bother to get up, he made his own way out. When she heard the door shut, she grabbed a sleep shirt, quick walked out to lock the apartment door. She wanted a shower, and turned into the bathroom she shared with me in their tiny apartment. The fact that it boasted two bedrooms and was reasonably close to the campus offset the fourth-floor walk-up, the unreliable hot water, and the sting of the monthly rent. But they were together. In New York. Sometimes they forgot to look for the ghost of the friend who wasn't there. Simone showered off the sex, stuck her head under the stingy spray of lukewarm water. She'd cut her hair into a short wedge and had recently dyed it the purple of a ripe eggplant. It made her feel different. It seemed she searched forever for something that made her feel different from the girl from Rockpoint, Maine. Something that would make her look in the mirror one day and think, oh, there you are. She liked New York. Liked the crowds, the rush, the noise, the color. And God, yes, the freedom from parental criticism, questions, and expectations. But she knew she'd come to fulfill Tish's dream. She liked Columbia, had worked her ass off to get in, but knew she'd done that to be a part of me's dream. She couldn't find her own, and wasn't sure she had one. But being there on borrowed dreams was better than being home where everything reminded her. Where her mother would look at her choice of hair color with puzzled disapproval, or her father, with that worried look in his eyes, would casually ask how she was doing. She was fine. How many times did she have to say it? It was me who still suffered from anxiety attacks and nightmares. Though they came less frequently now. She'd done everything possible to bury that night along with her friend. Since Mee's release from the hospital, Simone read nothing that connected to that night, watched no reports on it. Every anniversary she watched and read no news at all, in case she tripped over some mention. She went home only on winter break and for a week in the summer, and the summer week she spent on the island with Cece. When she wasn't in class, she worked. When she wasn't in class or working, she played. Hard. Out of the shower, she wrapped herself in a bath sheet, Egyptian cotton courtesy of her mother, then swiped off the skinny mirror over the teacup sink. No, she thought. Not yet. She saw a girl with tired eyes and wet hair, and nothing more. She hung the towel, dragged the sleep shirt back on. When she stepped out of the bathroom, she saw me in their sorry excuse of a kitchen, putting a kettle on their two-burner stove. Can't sleep?
Restless.
I heard the door. Mi had let her hair grow into a straight rain of black. When she turned, Simone saw another pair of tired eyes.
I'm sorry. Doesn't matter. Do I know him?
I don't think so. Doesn't matter either. Moving into the kitchen, Simone got out two cups. The music was good and he wasn't a bad dancer. I wish you'd come with me.
I needed to study.
You're acing everything. Again.
Because I study.
Simone waited while Mi fiddled with the tea. Something's up, I can see it.
I've been accepted for a summer research program.
That's great, like last summer? Dr. Jung, biomedical engineer.
That's the dream. Not exactly like last summer. The program's in London.
Holy shit, Mi!
Grabbing her friend, Simone danced her around the room.
London! You're going to London!
It's not until the end of June, and my family's asked me to come home first. To spend the time, after the semester ends and before I leave for London, at home. I need to give them that.
Okay.
Maybe her heart dropped a little, but Simone nodded.
Come home with me. Come home, Simone.
I've got a job.
You hate that job,
Mi interrupted.
If you want a waitress at some dump of a coffee house, you can do it anywhere. You're not happy here. You're doing okay at Columbia, but it doesn't make you happy. You have sex with guys that don't make you happy.
Rock Point's not going to make me happy.
Trim, tiny, with that gymnast's grace, Mi went back to finish making the tea.
You need to find what does. You're here because of Mi and Tish, and I'm not going to be here all summer. You should find what makes you happy. Your art...
Don't do that,
she snapped when Simone rolled her eyes.
You've got talent.
Cece has talent. I'm just playing around.
So stop playing around,
Mi snapped again.
Stop playing around. Stop screwing around. Stop fucking around.
Wow. Simone picked up the tea she no longer wanted, leaned back on a fridge manufactured in the last century.
I like playing around, screwing around, and fucking around. I'm not going to spend my life studying, researching, holed up in a lab because I don't want to have a life. Jesus, when's the last time you had sex?
You have enough for both of us.
Maybe if you got laid, you wouldn't be such a bitch. You won't go to parties, won't go to clubs, you haven't had a date in months. It's school, labs, or this shithole apartment. Happy my ass!
As her eyes fired, Mi curled one hand into a fist.
I'm going to make something of myself. I didn't die, and I'm going to make something out of my life. I am happy. Sometimes it's almost happy, and sometimes I hit it. But I know I'm working towards something, and I'm watching my best friend pushing back at everything. I go to classes, I go to work, I go to clubs. How's that pushing back at anything, much less everything?
You go to classes, but you don't care enough about any of them to do more than get by. You go to work at a job that means less than nothing to you instead of looking for something that would.
It poured out now, a flood over a broken dam.
You go to clubs because you can't stand being alone, being quiet for more than an hour, and you hook up with guys you have no intention of seeing again because you have no intention of seeing them again. Not letting yourself be close or involved with anything or anyone is the freaking definition of pushing everything away.
Simone smirked, adding nasty to it. I was damn close to the guy who just left.
What's his name?
Austin. Angel. Adam. Shit.
Ansel,
she remembered.
You had to dig for it. You brought some guy home, had sex with him, and have to dig for his name in less than an hour.
So what? So the fuck what? If I'm such a hoe, why do you care what I do? What I feel?
Because, goddammit, you're my hoe.
Simone opened her mouth to rage, and laughter gurgled out. As Mi, face bright pink with temper, tears of fury sparking in her eyes, stared at her, the gurgle built into a roll. Even as Mi let out an insulted huff, Simone toasted with her tea.
This calls for a t-shirt. Mi, he's hoe.
She tapped her free hand on her chest.
While she knuckled temper tears out of her eyes, the absurdity pushed a watery laugh out of me.
You'd wear it proud, too. Why wouldn't I?
Oh, hell, Sim.
Me set her tea aside, scrubbed her hands over her face.
I love you. I know. I know.
You're wasting yourself, taking classes you can basically sleep through.
I'm never going to be a biomedical freaking engineer, me. Most of us are still figuring stuff out.
The only courses you've shown any real interest in are art-related. So focus there and figure it out. You're wasting yourself on a job you don't like, don't need, where you're so stupidly overqualified you should be running the shop.
I don't want to run the shop.
A lot of people don't like their jobs. And I need it because I'm going to at least pay for some of my own expenses.
Then find a job you like. You're wasting yourself on sex with men you don't care about.
Now Simone had her own tears to knuckle away.
I don't want to care about anybody right now. I don't know if I ever will. I can care about you, about my family, and that's all I've got.
I think it's sad I value you more than you value yourself. So it's a good thing I'm around to bitch and nag at you.
You're really good at it.
I'm president of the Bitch and Nag Club. You barely qualify as an honorary member.
Take the summer, Sim. We can hang out at the beach until I leave for London. You can spend time with Cece. Even let her take you around Europe like she wanted to after graduation. We can sublet the apartment. Don't stay here alone.
I'll think about it. That's what you say when you want me to shut up.
Maybe.
Look, I'm tired and I've got to be at the shop at 8 to do the job I don't like. I want to get some sleep. Me nodded, dumped the tea neither of them had finished in the sink. Simone knew the quality of that silence, and it read anxiety.
Sleep over time? She suggested.
Me's shoulders dropped in relief.
That'd be good.
We'll use your virginal bed for obvious reasons. She slung an arm around me as they walked to Mee's bedroom.
I got Aaron's number.
Maybe he has a friend.
You said his name was Ansel. Damn it.
They crawled into Mee's bed, snuggled together for comfort.
I miss her,
Mee murmured.
I know. Me too.
I think I'd feel different about New York just being here if she were. If Tish were here, we'd be different.
Everything would be, Simone thought. She dreamed of it, of sitting with me, watching Tish alive and vital on stage, in the spotlight, just owning it. She dreamed of me working in her lab, so crisp and brilliant in her white coat. And when the dreams turned inward, she saw herself sitting on a raft on a still and silent sea. Drifting nowhere. She woke to the reality of serving the college crowd fancy, overpriced coffee, most paid for with credit cards given to them by their parents, and they still couldn't be bothered to tack on a decent tip. When she found herself, for the second time that week, scrubbing out the toilet in the unisex bathroom, she took yet another good look at herself in the mirror. She knew the fuckhead of a manager dumped the bathroom duty on her twice as often as anyone else because she wouldn't have sex with him. Married, at least 40, ponytail, so yuck.
So screw it, she told herself.
She walked out of air that smelled like bleach and fake lemons into the constant hum of espresso machines and conversations pontificating about politics or whining about relationships. She pulled off the stupid red apron she had to pay to have laundered, got her purse out of the skinny locker, the rent of which also came out of her sorry excuse for a paycheck. Manager Fuckhead sneered at her.
It's not time for your break.
You're wrong about that. It's past time for my break. I quit. She strolled out into the world of noise and color and realized she felt something she'd missed for entirely too long.
She felt happy.
6 months after graduating from the academy, Reed rode patrol with Bull Stockwell. Officer Titus Stockwell had earned the name Bull not only from his physicality but from his personality. A 15-year vet, Bull was foul-mouthed, hard-assed, and claimed to have a nose that could detect bullshit from 2 miles off. He had several red flags that caused him to charge, including anything he considered anti-American, a sliding scale, assholes, a wide range of qualifications, and motherfuckers. His top candidates for motherfuckers were anyone who harmed children, beat women, or abused animals. He hadn't voted for Obama, he'd never voted for a Democrat in his life, and saw no reason to deviate. But the man was President of the United States, and as such, had his respect and loyalty. He didn't have a bigoted bone in his body. He knew assholes and motherfuckers came in every color and creed. He might not understand the whole gay thing, but didn't actually give a shit one way or the other. He figured if you wanted to get off with somebody built the same as you, that was your business. He had 2 divorces under his Sam Brown belt. From the first, a 10-year-old daughter he unabashedly worshipped, and he owned a 1-eyed, 1-legged cat he'd rescued after a drug bust. Most days he berated Reed verbally for being too stupid, too slow, a college boy, and a dumbass rookie. And in the 6 months since he'd been on the job, Reed had learned more about the down-and-dirty and nitty-gritty of cop work than he had in all his college courses or in his months at the academy. He'd sure as hell learned, when answering a domestic disturbance call, to put himself between Bull and the offending party, male, before that red flag had his partner pawing the ground and snorting. So when they rolled up to a potential double D in a townhome they'd visited for the same reason 4 times before, Reed prepared to do just that.
"She's got an RO on him now, so his ass is mine."
Reed recalled the she in question, one LaDonna Gray, had taken her husband, one Vic Gray, back after a black eye and split lip, and again after a broken arm and clear-cut marital rape. But the 3rd incident, knocking her unconscious and knocking out 2 teeth, 2 months after she'd given birth to their son, had been the restraining order charm.
"He better not have touched that baby."
Bull hitched up his pants as they started for the door, down a frost-heavy walkway slushy with snow. A woman ran out of the connecting unit.
"He's killing her! I swear this time he's killing her!"
Reed heard it now. The screams, the shouts, the wails from the baby. He had time to think, oh shit. He saw, too, the front door had already been broken in. He went through the doorway with his partner, noted the signs of violence on the main level with the overturned table, broken lamp. Upstairs, the baby screamed as if someone had shoved an ice pick through his ear, but the shouts, curses, sobs, thuds came from the rear of the house. Reed moved faster than Bull, younger, longer legs, and had time to see Vic Gray bolt out the back door. The woman lay moaning, sobbing, bleeding on the kitchen floor.
"I've got him."
Reed sprinted out the back. As he ran, he called it in.
"Officer Quartermain in pursuit of suspect in assault. Suspect is Victor Gray, Caucasian male, age 28, heading south on Prospect on foot. Suspect is 5'10", 180 pounds. He's wearing a black parka, red watch cap, jeans, turning east on Mercer."
Gray cut across a yard, carving a path through the 8 inches of snow from the fall the night before, scaled a fence. Reed thought how much faster he'd be if he had his Nikes instead of the uniform shoes. His breath in visible clouds, Reed went over the fence, dropped into snow, heard screams, kicked up his speed. He hadn't lettered in track in high school for nothing. He spotted a woman sprawled in the snow in her yard beside a half-built snowman. With her nose dripping blood, she clutched a wailing toddler.
"He tried to grab my baby!"
Reed kept going, saw Gray cut east again, reported it as he gained on him. He went over another fence, saw Gray veer toward the open door of another townhome where music and a woman's laugh pumped out. Reed heard the woman say,
"I don't need to see how well you shoveled the patio. Close the door, it's cold."
His only thought, he's not getting in there and hurting somebody else. Reed may not have been his father's football star, but he knew how to tackle. He leaped, left the ground, and took Gray out at the knees on the narrow patio outside the open door. When Gray's face scraped along the stone, he screamed.
Hey! Hey, what the fuck?
A man stepped out, wine glass in one hand, iPhone in the other.
Jesus Christ, he's bleeding all over the place! I'm recording this! I'm recording this! This is police brutality!
You go ahead and record it.
Out of breath, with his own bones rattled from the hit, Reed pulled out his cuffs.
Go ahead and record the asshole who beat his wife to a pulp a few blocks over, assaulted a second woman, and tried to kidnap her child as a hostage. The guy who was heading straight into your house.
I've got him, Reed reported into his radio. Suspects contained, may require medical attention. What's the address here?
I don't have to tell you, dick!
Shut up, Jerry!
The woman who'd been laughing shoved the man with the phone aside.
It's 5237 Gilroy Place, officer.
In the rear of 5237 Gilroy Place. Thank you, ma'am. Victor Gray, you're under arrest for assault, 2 counts, for battery.
He snapped the cuffs on Gray's wrists.
For attempted child abduction, resisting arrest, and violating the terms of a restraining order.
That man has rights.
Reed looked up.
Are you a lawyer, sir?
No, but I know-
Then why don't you stop interfering with police business?
You're on private property.
My property,
the woman said.
So shut the hell up, Jerry.
You're bleeding some too, officer.
He tasted it in his mouth, felt it on the stinging heels of his hands.
I'm okay, ma'am. Victor Gray, you have the right to remain silent.
As he recited the Miranda warning, Jerry smirked.
Took you long enough.
Not a lawyer?
Reed pulled Gray to his feet.
Just a dick in general. I'm filing a complaint.
That's it. Out. Get out of my house, Jerry.
Reed heard the sirens as the woman handed the dick his ass. Since she appeared to have that situation under control, he stiff-walked Gray around to the front of the house.
I'm gonna sue your fucking ass,
Gray mumbled.
Yeah, you do that, Vic.
LaDonna Gray suffered 3 broken ribs, a broken wrist, a broken nose, 2 black eyes, a shattered cheekbone, and internal injuries. Her son wasn't harmed. Sheridan Bobbitt, who'd been in her yard playing with her 2-year-old, sustained minor injuries, and the minor child had some bruises on his arms and shoulders. According to her statement, Gray had rushed into her yard, knocked her down. She'd fought him when he attempted to yank her son out of her arms, then he had run away when a police officer had come over the fence in pursuit. Eloise Matherson, resident of 5237 Gilroy Place, served as an eyewitness of the takedown and arrest, stating she'd seen through her open door the man identified as Victor Gray running toward her house, saw the officer tackle him just a foot away from her door, and restrain him when Gray attempted to resist. She expressed her gratitude for the officer stopping a violent man from entering her home. And gave Reed her number on the sly. Bull dumped the paperwork on Reed. That's how it went for rookies. And Reed overheard him talking to the hospital, checking on LaDonna Gray's condition. By the time Reed had filed the paperwork, Jerry the Dick's phone video hit the local newscasts. Reed took the ribbing. That's how it went for cops. Winced a little at the cold fury on his face, and figured he'd take some heat from his CO over the dick remark.
You hit the internet already, Quartermain.
One of the other uniforms tapped a computer screen.
McMullen's blog!
Crap.
Aw, she calls you young and studly and...
What?
She brings up the Down East Mall. Don't sweat it, Rook. Nobody reads her bullshit.
Everybody read it, Reed thought, including cops. Just like Plenty had read the book she'd published the year before. Massacre Down East. With her buzz, the likelihood of the damn phone video going viral and national catapulted to the top of the heap. He knew the word had already started burning when Essie, now Detective McVee with the Portland PD, stepped in, signaled to him. She walked him into the currently empty roll call room.
You okay?
Yeah, sure.
Something left a mark. She tapped a finger to his bruised jaw.
Hit the back of his head on the takedown. It's okay.
Get some ice on it. The media is going to play with this a little. Young hero of Down East Mall becomes hero cop with a bite. And like that.
He shoved at his hair. Cop short, as his sergeant insisted he keep his loosely curling mop trim.
Shit, Essie.
You'll deal. Your sergeant's going to give you a little flick over the dick remark, but he and every cop in Portland and its burbs is going to give you a nice golf clap over it. Don't worry about it, and don't worry about McMullen or the rest of the media. Keep your head down and do the job.
Well, I was,
he pointed out. That's right. And what the Dick's video showed was a cop doing his job, maintaining his composure and control, with the exception of a muttered word. A word the video also shows was well-earned by said Dick. You did it right, Reed. And I wanted you to hear that from me, since I feel I had something to do with getting you in that uniform.
You had a lot to do with it. I felt I had to get him. When I saw that woman bleeding on the floor, I had to get him. It wasn't like a flashback sort of thing. I didn't flashback to that night or anything like that, but it was sort of like when I knew I had to get that kid.
Instincts, Reed.
You've got them.
With approval, she gave him a fake punch on his bruised jaw. Keep using them. And learn from Bull. He's a solid son of a bitch despite his bullshit.
He rides my ass. That's not a complaint. Especially. He was gentle as a priest with LaDonna Gray. I guess that's something I'm learning from him, how to handle victims so they don't feel so victimized.
That's a good one. How about you come to dinner next week?
I could eat. Are you still seeing that professor?
Some cop you are. She held up her left hand, wiggled her fingers to show off the ring.
Holy shit, Essie!
He started to reach out, stopped himself.
I can't hug a detective in the precinct. It'll wait. He's a lucky guy.
Damn right. If you need to talk, you know who to call. I'll text you about dinner.
He went straight to the locker room to change out of uniform. He'd been off shift since before he'd filed the paperwork. He found Bull hanging up his own uniform jacket.
You finished getting kissed from the detective bureau? Can't kiss her. She just got engaged. Huh. Cops ought to know better than to get married.
He pulled on a plain white t-shirt.
Did you call that civilian witness a dick when you fucking knew he was recording you?
It's on the recording, so I'd be stupid to deny saying it.
Well.
Studying himself in his locker mirror, Bull scraped a hand over his crew cut.
Looks like I'm going to buy you a beer.
He shut his locker.
You might make a half-decent cop after all.
Chapter 6 Patricia Jane Hobart devoured McMullen's blog along with a bowl of veggie sticks with gobs of hummus. She'd been a tubby child, routinely indulged by her mother with cookies, snack cakes, and her favorite M&Ms. Her interests, computers, reading, watching TV, and the occasional video game, merged well with her appetites. She'd often consumed an entire bag of Oreos, she preferred double stuff chilled in the fridge, washed down with a liter of Coke while immersed in a spy novel, a murder mystery, the occasional romance, or testing her hacking skills. While her father, redneck loser, and mother, hapless idiot, battled their marriage to dust, she enjoyed playing one against the other and reaping the rewards of more chaos and more cookies. By the age of 12, she carried 160 pounds on a height of 5 feet 2 inches. She played her teachers and neighbors as slyly as her parents, wearing the mask of a stoic child bullied by her peers. She was, in fact, bullied, but she invited it, embraced it, and used it to her advantage. While the adults stroked and cosseted her, she plotted and executed vengeance with the stealth and focus a CIA operative would admire. The boy who dubbed her Patty the Porker took a flying header off his Schwinn when the chain she'd compromised snapped.
She considered his fractured jaw, broken teeth, hospital stay, and the thousands for dental work his parents had to shell out almost enough payback. The ringleader of the girls who'd stolen her underpants while she was in the shower after gym, and then creatively tacked them to a drawing of an elephant before posting them on the bulletin board, nearly died when the peanuts Patricia crushed to powder and slipped into her thermos of hot cocoa sent her into anaphylactic shock. By the time she hit her teens, Patricia was a virtuoso of vengeance. Occasionally, she enlisted the aid of her brother, the only person in the world she loved almost as much as herself. Her schemes engaged him. She plotted several for him as well, enough to keep their bond strong after the divorce. She hated that JJ lived with their worthless father, hated that he actually preferred it. She understood why. He could run wild with no repercussions, sneaking beer and weed while she remained stuck with their whiny martyr of a mother. But JJ depended on her. He wasn't particularly bright, so he needed her help with schoolwork. He had impulse control problems and needed her to remind him that payback worked best when carefully crafted. She enjoyed nothing more than carefully crafting payback. At 17, her brother too often showed the world the angry, violent, bitter beast. On the other hand, Patricia's quiet, studious, kid with a weight problem facade hid a cunning, brutal psychopath. Perfectly aware that teenage boys, and she considered all men on that level, would stick their dicks in anything, she had sex with both Whitehall and Paulson. She calculated it as a way to control them, useful tools, and to make them believe they controlled her. JJ knew better, but blood was thicker. She devised the plan. A mass shooting that would shake the core not just of the community she despised, but the city, the entire country. She worked on it for months, selecting and rejecting locations, refined and refined the timing, the weaponry. She told no one, not even JJ, until she'd settled on the mall. The mall, where giggling teenage girls who treated her like dirt ran in packs. Where perfect parents with their perfect kids had pizza and went to the movies. Where old people who should just die already walked in their ugly tracksuits or rode around on scooters. She considered the mall a perfect location for payback on everyone and everything she despised. Even after she told JJ, she swore him to secrecy. He could tell no one, could write down nothing they discussed. When the time was right, when she had everything in place, all contingencies nailed down, they could bring in his two friends. She walked miles in the mall, joining those revolting old people for their pre-opening exercise, and letting them make her a pet. She took photographs, made maps, studied mall security, took off a little weight as cover, and directed JJ to get a part-time job at the mall. He chose the theater, so she worked that sector in for him. By her calculations, Operation Born to Kill would go green mid-December, giving her time to work out kinks and capitalizing on the holiday crowds for the most impact. They would take out hundreds. But then JJ literally jumped the gun and hadn't even told her. After all the work she'd done, he'd let his impulses rule him. She found out about the shooting from a bulletin when the local news broke in during a rerun of Friends. She'd had to scramble to destroy her notes, her maps, her photos, every scrap of 6 months' work. She hid her laptop in a neighbor's broken-down garden shed. She'd bought the laptop, used exclusively for the mall project, for cash when visiting her grandparents in their big-ass fancy house in Rock Point. The cops would come, she knew. They'd question her, her mother. They'd search the ratty, wrong-side-of-the-tracks rental from top to bottom. They'd talk to neighbors, teachers, other students. Because JJ would get caught.
Even if he had followed her plan as she'd laid it out so far, he'd get caught. He'd never implicate her, but his two asshole friends would. But the cops would have nothing but that. The word of two assholes against a 15-year-old girl, a distinguished honor roll student without a single mark on her record. While she paced, waiting for the next bulletin, she worked out what she'd say, how she'd react, every word, every expression, her body language. Shock and deep, genuine grief dropped her to the floor when the grim-eyed reporter announced the shooters, believed to number three, were dead. Not JJ. Not the only person in the world who knew her and gave two shits about her. Not her brother. That grief rose up in a single wail. Then she shoved it back. She'd save it for the police. Save it for her idiot mother when the cops pulled her out of her second job, cleaning the offices of a bunch of lying lawyers. She'd save it for the cameras. And when they came, when they notified her and questioned her with her trembling mother beside her, when they searched the house from top to bottom, talked to the neighbors, they'd see a 15-year-old girl in shock. A girl who clung to her mother and sobbed. A girl as innocent as her brother was guilty. As expected, her mother fell apart. Her father raged and picked up a bottle he'd never come out of. She bore up, asked one of the lawyers from the offices where her mother cleaned to help write a statement expressing their shock and horror and grief. A statement, she insisted tearfully, that apologized to everyone. And because her parents couldn't handle it, she read the statement herself through choked sobs. They had to move. She secreted the laptop in a box of stuffed animals. They couldn't move far. Her mother needed her jobs, and her employers kept her on. She finished her high school years with a tutor. Her wealthy paternal grandparents paid. She kept her head down and gathered her vengeance to her, preparing to serve it ice cold. At 18, she carried a sharply honed 112 on a 5-foot-4-inch frame. Her family attributed her initial weight loss to stress and grief, but Patricia worked to turn herself into a whippy weapon. She had people to kill, and compiled dossiers on all of them. Time, she calculated, remained on her side, and she had college to finish. With her stellar grades and smarts, she had numerous choices, and settled on Columbia as two of her targets, and the one, her primary, chose it. How better to keep tabs on the person she held most responsible, even more than the cop who'd put the bullets in him, for her brother's death? Without Simone Knox, the cops didn't get there so quickly, didn't enter the movie theater, didn't kill her brother. He'd have walked out the way he'd walked in, but for Simone Knox. She could have killed Knox and finished JJ's job on her little Asian friend 1,000 times already. But the dish was not cold enough. And they would be far from the first to pay. On the food chain of her revenge, she'd placed her parents first. But now, reading McMullen's blog in the studio apartment her grandparents paid for, she just couldn't live with people. She reconsidered. Not the cop, and not the boy hero who'd become one. They ranked too high to be shifted that far down. But maybe, just maybe, she could pick one of the lessers, run a kind of test. She munched her hummus and veggie sticks in an apartment across the street from her prime target and began the selection process. On July 22, 2005, Roberta Flisk was 36. She'd gone to the mall with her sister and her young niece to have the 10-year-old Caitlin's ears pierced. They'd planned to conclude the rite of passage with ice cream sundaes. But as Caitlin, with her tiny gold studs, Shelby, carrying the bag of overpriced daily cleaner, and Roberta strolled out of the earring boutique, everything changed. Roberta stopped at a kiosk to buy her little boy some beach toys for his long weekend away with his grandparents.
She and her husband had planned their own long weekend on Mount Desert Island in hopes of reviving their troubled marriage. Later, she'd tell police, her family, reporters, how she'd seen the boy identified as Kent Francis Whitehall come into the mall as she, her sister, and her niece walked toward the same doors. She'd thought he was wearing a costume for some event, until he'd lifted the rifle. Her sister was the first victim of the attack. As she'd fallen, Caitlin screamed, dropping to the ground with her mother. Roberta threw herself over her niece and sister. Whitehall shot her twice, left shoulder, left leg, before he'd moved on to other targets. With her sister dead, her niece traumatized, her own injuries requiring 2 surgeries and months of therapy, physical and emotional, Roberta hadn't been shy about talking to the press. She became a passionate, vocal advocate for gun regulation. She helped launch For Shelby, an activist organization dedicated to safe, sane solutions. Their website and Facebook page ran totals daily of the number of gun deaths in the country. Murder, suicide, accidental. Her marriage died, another victim of Down East. She gave speeches, organized rallies and marches, appeared on television, always wearing the heart locket that held a photo of her sister. In tragedy, she became a warrior, a name and a face, a well-known voice not only locally but nationally. For that reason, she fit Patricia's needs perfectly. Patricia took a full month to study, to stalk, to take notes and photos, to plan. Back in Rockpoint for most of the summer, ostensibly to spend time with her grandparents, she made meticulous records of Roberta's habits, routines. In the end, she found it ridiculously easy. Early one morning, before daybreak, she slipped out of her grandparents' house, jogged a half mile to the home of one of her grandmother's friends. After slipping on a short blonde wig and latex gloves, she removed the spare key to the car from the magnetic box under the wheel well. She drove, carefully at the speed limit, to Roberta's quiet neighborhood, parked, took the gun and the silencer, taken from her father during one of his drunken stupors, out of her backpack. At sunrise, like clockwork, Roberta came out of her back door. On a normal day, she would have cut across her own backyard, through a neighbor's gate, and met up with the first of her 2 morning jogging companions. But on this morning, Patricia waited. She stepped out from behind a sturdy red maple. As Roberta, adjusting her earbuds, glanced over in surprise, Patricia took her down with 2 quick shots to the chest. The silencer kept the sound to a harmless pop. The 3rd shot, a kill shot to the head, popped louder, but it had to be done. She took the sign she'd made out of the backpack, tossed it on Roberta's body. "Here's your 2nd Amendment, bitch." She policed her brass, secured them with the gun and silencer in the backpack. Light streaked in reds and pinks across the eastern sky as she drove back to the neighbors, replaced the key. With the wig and gloves in her backpack, she took out earbuds, put them in, and began to jog. She felt nothing special, she realized. She'd expected to feel some elation or amazement. Something. But she felt no more than she did when she completed a necessary task well. A little satisfaction. She jogged, as she'd made a habit to do since observing Roberta's morning routines, toward a bakery a full mile away. She listened for the news reports, and the speculation that Roberta's visible and vocal advocacy had made her the target for some gun rights nut. Time to wait again, she decided. To wait and plot and study. But the test? She'd aced it. Killing was easy if you just made a plan and stuck to it. She went into the bakery, got a big welcoming smile from the woman, Carol, who opened it every morning. "Hey there, Patricia. Right on time."
"Gorgeous day."
Beaming back, Patricia jogged lightly in place.
How about 3 of those apple muffins today, Carol?
You got it. It's real sweet of you to get your grandparents a treat every morning.
Best grandparents ever.
I don't know what I'd do without them.
Patricia dug the money out of the side pocket of her backpack and, angling it away, unzipped the main pack to tuck the